Apes Together Strong. In honor of Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes in theaters this weekend, what is cinema's most memorable, not King Kong, ape or monkey?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with the chimpanzee attack in Nope, which has haunted me. I don't remember the name of that chimpanzee, but I do remember what happened next. Still sticking with me.
I am Matt Patches, and I'm going to have to go with Jack from MVP, Most Valuable Primate. It's right there in the title.
Yeah. I'm David the Seven, and Katie said maybe we've done this before. And you know what? After at least 474 episodes, it's very possible.
It's a real Dave Gonzalez prompt, I gotta say that.
Well, I'm probably answered the exact same way that I'm going to answer now, which is Amy, good gorilla. It's from Congo. It's a person in a suit.
I'm David Ehrlich, and has anyone said Dunstan from Dunstan Checks In?
I heard he checked in.
He has yet
in.
To check in. He has yet to check in. Mm. Would you like to check him in?
You know,
let him check
I'm
let
typically
check
not
in.
A big fan of monkeys on screen, but I like when
really?
They check in.
Why? What? Can you unpack that?
Dramatically, they're like people, but they smell worse. Mm. Like they're not. They're less complex. I don't know. I don't really see the appeal. I've never really.
Oh, talk about prime
I've never really given
hate.
A shit. I was not especially excited for fucking new Planet of the Apes movie, even though it turns out to be pretty good.
Hey. Yeah, we'll talk about that. Well, I mean, he's not going to be here when we talk about that, so I guess it's fine.
Good lightning round.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine, too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 474. It is the week of Wednesday, May 8th. That was the day that in 1958, the Dracula by Hammer films premiered. I guess it's just one film that premiered, but it became multiple. It introduced audiences to Christopher Lee as Dracula and Peter Cushing as Van Helsing. So we just put out like monster movies in May back then. I support it.
I mean, I'm all for it. I spent a lot of time this weekend watching videos about the upcoming epic universe, which includes a very dark universe. Yeah,
you spent time this weekend watching videos about the epic universe.
Yeah,
what?
Because there's like it's
didn't
under construction.
Didn't you like months ago realize you have so little time on this planet?
I mean, yes, but also it was not great weather here over the weekend. What else are you supposed to do? Yeah, I can't wait to see Dracula and Van Helsing in an epic universe. Maybe we should all go. I'll go to the dark universe
live
show like we were talking about
from Epic Universe.
With every time we talk about like you know a work related reason to like go to Universal Studios, I'm like, I need to do that.
I mean,
excuse to spend too much money.
I'm writing a book about Harry Potter, and I should probably go to all the theme parks. So you know, if you guys, want to join
did
me?
We say
why
congrats
not?
On that.
It's new news.
Since the last time we did a show, I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yeah,
well,
since last. Well, this is we're allowed to talk about it publicly now.
You're
I think
writing
you guys
a book
all knew
about Harry Potter. Didn't they already do like 7 of those?
Oh yeah,
see
it's
say?
Not a it's,
movies?
It's not
they
a fiction
eight?
Book.
Oh, yeah, they did 8 movies, but
they did 8
books.
About Harry Potter. And they did more about that world, but yeah, it's gonna be like a franchise history. It's gonna be fun.
No, if I'm sure if they made other movies in the Harry Potter universe, I would have heard about it.
That's a good point. You think that franchise would be taken off? Yeah, the Hot Dumbledore franchise. I will do this part, I guess. We have one app review.
Wow. I feel like I missed my cue. I'm so sorry.
Well, we get to let David read this, which is funny because, once again, people are not happy with David Ehrlich.
Not the first time, not the last time.
Nope.
Fau Danu, 3 stars. Ehrlich is the worst. I mean, the fact that we still get 3 stars is probably a testament to the rest of you. So
I'll take it.
Yeah. I wish they had some kind of marker to let me know which episodes don't have David Ehrlich on them. We could do, like the Ghost in the Shell series, Standalone Complex, the anime, would have different color title cards for the episodes, depending on whether or not they fit into the overall narrative arc of the season, or if there were standalone episodes, we could consider something like that. Every take he has is extremely snobbish and condescending. It's almost as if they put him on the show just to be at odds with otherwise pleasant hosts who offer nuanced takes that appreciate most art for what it is. Ehrlich seems to have some sort of genetic defect that prevents him from simply enjoying, and you're making this about my family now, from simply enjoying a movie, but rather finding every fault and interrupting his co-host to complain about said faults. I roll my eyes every time his voice forces its way into the conversation. His negativity is insufferable and is the sole reason I don't consider myself a bigger fan of this show. I mean, Faudanu, I have to say, the reason that you love my other co-host so much is simply because I'm here to make them look good. This is the role that I serve. Every simply show not. Needs a fall guy, and mm-hmm. Ryan Gosling was unavailable, and so here I am.
I like that there's the assumption that any of us are on this podcast for a reason instead of just bound by friendship obligation.
No, we were cast by Lou Pearlman, like the Backstreet Boys. They were put together like a team.
And then he stole all our money. Yeah. How that happened.
Motherfucker.
Well, you could also, if you don't want to leave app reviews, but thank you for doing that. For a second, we were wondering if it was working. You could also email us at fitwr.podcast@gmail.com. We have one new email this week. This the subject of this is searching for Bobby Fischer and Taylor Swift. Two patches wondering if it were ever discussed searching for Bobby Fischer. Indeed, you did on a Quarter Quell from 2016 called Movies You Would Show Your Children. I visited this episode last summer in anticipation of my first child and laughed heartily at Katie backtracking on the Music Man with, if my kid is growing up in the era of Trump, then this is all irrelevant. Oh, prescience.
Oh, as no.
As of yet, my 7-week-old son has seen L.A. Confidential and all 6 seasons of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Hey. Fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
As long as I'm writing, and because of the general ubiquity of Taylor Swift, seems to be an evergreen topic for Fitware, somebody really ought to address, was Claire Denis mean to Taylor Swift? Here's what we know. Okay. Taylor Swift has a Michael Jordan-esque ability to turn slights into gold, having elevated her cultural relevance and taking on that Colorado radio DJ Scooter Braun, Katy Perry, etc. In November 2021, Swift and Jack Antonoff both show up on the set of Denis' directed Stars at Noon, ostensibly to support their respective partners, Margaret Qualley and Joe Alwyn. Swift and Antonoff soon leave the set to record the album Midnights in its entirety. We know that Claire Denis does not suffer fools and can make intelligent people feel like fools, having taken David Sims down a peg for trying to make small talk about salad or something. Well, Swift waits.
I'm so glad we all still think about that, or at least two of them, me and this person.
Swift waits almost a year to release Midnights on October 21st, 2022, 1 week after Stars at Noon's muted VOD release, and 1 week before it goes to Hulu. Also, it's called Midnights, which is literally the opposite of noon. On Antihero, she even says, "Midnights become my afternoons." Shortly after Midnights' release, Taylor Swift sets up a deal with her Searchlight Pictures to develop a feature from her original script and presents to the All Too Well short film at Tribeca in Toronto, seemingly pushing for Oscar consideration, another group that has slighted her on more than one occasion. My Swiftie wife has absolutely no interest in this theory, but let me call it here. But let me call it here. It will someday come to light that Swift sought to conquer the film industry largely because Claire Denis tore her a new asshole for asking about lenses or something. You all take work. You all do great work. So glad Katie is employed again. Yeah. Brendan.
Wow. Here for this.
I'm also here for this.
The Midnight Stars at Noon comparison is very compelling to me.
Stars at Noon was my flyer pick for a year in advance best picture winner on Little Gold Men a couple years ago. Didn't pan out.
No. doesn't feel like that panned out for you now.
I gave a shot.
Even now in our post, you know, Moonlight and Parasite world where more interesting movies are in that conversation, Claire Denis winning best picture feels like a bridge too far.
The
but
theory was just like, hey, foreign auteurs are like doing well at the Oscars. Claire Denis is next. Well, still waiting.
Fau Danu might be perplexed to know that I am one of the few people who like that movie.
I've never seen it.
Well, you know who doesn't like it, apparently? Taylor Swift. We'll have to monitor what she says moving forward. Speaking of moving forward, let's get on with the podcast. It's the dream. Oh.
first segment tonight. Yeah, if you love David and his positive takes and his love of cinema, you're going to love what he thinks about Jerry Seinfeld's new film, Unfrosted. It debuted on Netflix. It is a comedy. It's a romp, I would say. Can't believe it's his directorial debut, but I guess he doesn't really do many things, especially doesn't do
certainly
movies.
Doesn't feel like it was directed by someone who's directed anything before.
He didn't get a co-directing credit on B-movie? Sad for him. But yeah, he makes his directorial debut with this movie about the making of Pop-Tarts. Amazing that we have now watched two films on this podcast related to Kellogg's.
I did wonder Battle if there Creek, was Michigan. A Road to Wellville connection in Unfrosted. I know it's a different time period.
Yeah, Jim Gaffigan is playing a descendant of Kellogg in this movie. But yeah, Seinfeld is playing Bob Cabana, an employee of Kellogg's. He is like a marketing guy, I think. What is exactly his job? He's just like a man with ideas for how to innovate within the cereal industry, because they are in a complete standoff with Post Cereal, which is run by Amy Schumer. And they're just, it's like a rivalry, and they are now racing to invent the Pop-Tart, which Seinfeld is obsessed with. He loves cereal. If you know show and his stand-up, you know he's obsessed with cereal and Pop-Tarts, and he has taken this to the finish line of like making what looks like a very expensive movie. Bill Pope shot this movie. As we said, Seinfeld is directing it, but like maybe not in the most refined way. We'll get into how it feels as a movie, but it is basically an excuse to parade around funny people doing, and this is where our debate will come in, funny things, question mark. Now, David, you did not care for the comedy stylings of Jerry Seinfeld and the Pop-Tart bits. Can you explain why this landed with a thud to you? And then I will tell you that I kind of giggled my way through this very much enjoyed it.
I'm trash.
David, I'm trash. He's wrong.
That is.
I want you to start with your take about why
that is another damning indictment against this movie. I'm afraid to say.
There are many funny jokes, and I will talk about them after you say why it's so terrible that he made a very goofy spin on Mad Men about the Pop-Tart.
In a more perfect world, this would be the least funny thing that's happened in the last 12 months, and sadly it is not. But it is a train wreck of a movie. I mean, I did not so much as smile one time. I yelled at my television during the cameo that is now, we were sworn to secrecy by Netflix, and then they spoiled it themselves within like 8 minutes of that movie.
Yeah, that's the only part I've seen.
Me too.
So desperate for people to watch it.
David spent months keeping it secret, and they just
let's just say Seinfeld really loves Mad Men.
Did you get like the vibe, given that this is set in the 60s and it's about products, like the entire time you're like, oh boy, he's trying to do a Mad Men thing? Or does it come
out of complete
nowhere when, to be clear, John Hamm and John Slatter show up as Sterling Cooper?
Okay, you just said it. There you go.
Are we not? Oh, come on. They tweeted it. They literally tweeted it.
They made a tweet. No, Seinfeld is obsessed with Mad Men. And during the COVID lockdown, he was imagining himself in Mad Men, knew he would never be on Mad Men, and then wrote himself Mad Men. In his form, and Netflix will pay out for a guy like Jerry Seinfeld, who never does anything and came to them to make a Pop-Tart movie. And it looks expensive. Like, there's big sets. Melissa McCarthy's the co-star. They're going to invent the Pop-Tart together. They're like on the moon landing, fake moon landing set at some point. They're in this fancy office throughout the movie. It's like a big, flashy, expensive production. And to the end of like just making goofs. It's nonstop goops. It's also goops. There's a lot of goopy stuff in the pop.
Nonstop goops.
But like it's reaching for Airplane, wouldn't you say, David? That it's trying to be maybe not that like punny or, you know, fantastical, but it's really just joke. Or in trying
or
to
no
be.
Joke, no joke, no
or
joke.
Or no joke. I don't understand why this title is such a thought.
It's terrible. I mean, it's like the whole joke of the movie is that it's so silly that they're making a movie that is modeled after the right stuff and movies about the space race and things of that nature. The, like the current war, the, like Tesla and Edison.
It's Oppenheimer with dummies.
It is like Oppenheimer. I mean, I said in my
review. There's even a scene where they invent the Pop-Tart and do dancing and drinking, and I was like,
there is a movie. There is a scene where they parody the Trinity test and the Pop-Tart explodes.
Really?
And, yes, but it's the movie is one joke with like 1,000 different punchlines. And it's a joke that isn't funny the first time. And then you have 90 more minutes of it.
Pop-Tarts are silly?
No, the joke is it's so silly that we're making a movie about the invention of Pop-Tarts, that we're taking it, you know, as serious. I mean, the vein they're going for is definitely, I thought, you know, not realizing that this movie was in the can 2 years ago and they've just been waiting for a time to fucking dump it, waiting for Jerry Seinfeld to go on Joe Rogan and talk about how, you know, you can't even make a Pop-Tart movie now because of woke, and then release it. but I thought that maybe, you know, my generous read was that it could have been sort of a parody of these like business biopics that we've had over recent years. I mean, they did exist before 2 years ago, but certainly in the last couple of years, gotten a lot more of them. The Beanie Baby movie came to mind a lot watching this. This feels sort of like the weird, as in like the Weird Al Yankovic biopic version of that, where it's like very, very silly, very surreal.
That movie wasn't half bad, though.
No, but because that movie was written by people who are at all tapped into what is funny in the world right now. And Jerry Seinfeld may have had that juice once upon a time, but it has long left his body. There's nothing going on here. There's no momentum. There's no eye for comedy. There's no wit to it. It's just throwing shit at a dartboard, a very small dartboard, and hoping that any of it will stick. Every joke is kind of, you know, they're all completely disjointed. Every scene feels like it was just built around whatever cameo they could get for it in the moment. None of them work. The Mad Men thing is the most amusing simply because of its audacity and the fact that they like kind of get the Don Draper and Roger Sterling voices right. Before the scene goes off the rails anyway, but
I think it's more successful than you give it credit for, kind of a throwback to these maybe 50s and 60s movies where it is just about famous people showing up and doing bits, maybe not quite Mad World or something, but the jokes do land. It is a weird movie, starting with these two demonic dumpster kids who Seinfeld meets in the beginning, who are helping him
dumpster
understand.
Dumpster kids?
Eat food out of a dumpster.
They eat food out of a dumpster.
They want to eat the Pop-Tarts, and they want to eat the goo. This just gets the movie... I'm giggling at this stuff. It's so weird, but in the Seinfeld mode. Like, it's still... It feels like a Seinfeld episode at times. It feels like Seinfeld's stand-up comedy, and it feels disjointed, David, because I think he doesn't mind just, like, making jokes and not necessarily having the narrative momentum. Like, you've seen a movie, that's how it's carrying you through this. It's cutting corners in that way. It's just a conveyor belt for these jokes and these cameos. Can it not be that? Like, does it need to be?
It could be that. Could be that if any of them were funny
Apatow's,
to me. I mean, obviously,
Bubble that had zero jokes.
No, that is a movie that I referenced explicitly in my review because it is the same recognizable and distinct stink of a COVID bubble produced movie where you can just feel the stir crazy Zoom calls that led to this complete lack of humor, the desperation to put something on a movie screen to get people together. This is an atrocious movie. Painfully unfunny.
So wrong. Let me throw in here.
Every
I got
second
step
of it
in here.
With the power of 1,000
Bobby Moynihan as Chef Boyardee. Can we talk about Chef Boyardee for a second?
They put sea monkeys into a sentient ravioli that has more screen time than anyone else in the cast. They hit the same joke 12 times. There's so many funny people in this movie. Bobby Moynihan is definitely one of them. None of them are really allowed to do anything
in this
funny
movie. Performed by the cereal mascots. Oh my god, I thought that was hilarious.
The way that they treat Rice Crackle, I cannot believe I'm saying these fucking words. This is not a terrorist win.
But the way played by Mikey Day, Kyle Mooney, and Drew Tarver.
And a third guy. I don't know who Drew Tarver is.
I don't want to know.
I recognize the first name. He's from the other two. I mean, again, he's slumming it here. But they can't really settle on a reality for these mascots. You have Hugh Grant as Thurl Raven. What's his name? Thurl Ravencroft.
I thought that would have won
real,
you over.
Whatever
he's
his name is. He's a real guy. He was a real guy. Yeah, he was a real guy. I mean, in this case, he's basically just doing Phoenix Buchanan light. You know, he's like, I'm a Shakespearean actor and I'm stuck. And then eventually he storms the Kellogg's building dressed as sort of the QAnon shaman at the end of the movie with leading the mascots. It's so fucking stupid.
That does sound stupid.
It's so fucking, and like Jerry Seinfeld's whole backhanded way of sort of like Trojan horsing his rear end into current events or somewhat current events at the timeline of this movie. When he's like too cowardly to touch the third rail in any meaningful way is embarrassing. And I'm just like so mystified by the idea of being a 70-year-old billionaire deciding that you're going to spend 2 years of your life making this fucking movie. Like,
Why do you hold that against him?
Hold that against it. Did I say I held that against him? I did not. I just said it was mystifying to me.
It sounds like you're holding it against.
It would be a lot less mystifying to me if any of it was funny. If I was like, oh, he had a funny idea and he pursued it. That's what comedians do. And I'm actually impressed that at his age and with his success, he is putting his, you know, sticking his neck out to whatever degree, you know, you can consider a Netflix movie sticking your neck out and making something new when he has only just been riding in cars with comedians and getting coffee for the last 20 years. And, you know, but the fact that this is like such, it's the anti-comedy. It is like a black hole of humorous thought. So many funny people are wasted in this. You can just feel them coming out to set and the James Marsdens and your there are other people.
So
I'm trying to think of like the funnier examples because I don't want to be like Sebastian Maniscalco. He's never funny.
Peter Dinklage? Do you like him as the leader of the Milkman Syndicate?
No, I mean, I love Peter Dinklage, but man, he's
are you telling me that when Melissa McCarthy, they cut to her just reading a Mad magazine for some reason, and her line is, boy, they don't pull any punches. That's funny. That's funny. Not coming out of my mouth.
I mean, Melissa McCarthy
is funny.
Melissa McCarthy, who is, I think if you were... had only seen movies made in the last 10 years, you would be like, that is an offensive statement. There's a humorous idea to her character in that, like, she's working at NASA and he's like, come on, do you really think you're going to get people on the moon? And she's like, no, come on, I'm going to go make Pop-Tarts. And like, I guess that's funny in a theoretical way.
What about
way.
Andy Daly playing the Quaker from Quaker Oats?
But again, it's like so.
You're just saying. I feel like you're just like saying things and being like, "That's like, funny,"
experience of watching the movie.
Well, explaining jokes is horribly unfunny. That's true.
But it's also like that's the thing. This is a movie that instructs you from the beginning. And then it's free, dumbass framing device and its entire tone to just sort of turn your brain off and go with it. And I'm like, that's totally fine. However, you cannot go out of your way to give me an excuse to tie my brain into knots when I have tried at your instruction to turn it off. The way that they treat the reality of these mascots, where like the Quaker Oats guy is a real guy and like Snap, Crackle and Pop are like they're like the monkeys, but like they're like kind of real and always in character. And it feels like they're just acting like Thurl Ravenwood, whatever his fucking name is. But when they go to a funeral, they pour milk and cereal into the casket and into the fucking grave. I mean, it's like it none of it adds up. There's no coherent line of thought. And this actually makes everything less funny. It's not just a semantic argument. This is a hateful, awful movie that could not be more. It could not be more innocent.
That's over the top.
The reason that I find it hateful is because of how little effort and talent, and like quality, was poured into it. It is an incredibly benign work unto itself. But like, can you imagine seeing this movie in a movie theater? Like,
no,
it's not
I can't.
The kind of
no,
thing
you're
like,
no. I'm with
no,
you there.
No, it never would have been in a theater,
and
right?
And it wouldn't play well at all. No, this is not. This is an at-home Netflix movie, but maybe like the best version of it. I think that some things are optimized for home viewing and that Seinfeld knows how to make TV, not movies. And I thought that this was fun in that way. I cannot imagine seeing it in a movie theater because of what you're saying. It wouldn't have that like narrative coherence. It would not feel like a cinematic moment.
If you
spent this is a stand-up comedy
a single
set
dollar for this,
super polished,
that wasn't just baked into your subscription fee, you would be outraged. And
I mean, like, maybe, but I don't have like that's the bargain. That's the point.
I mean, maybe I am more resistant than you are to the idea that movies that we are replacing the movies that we know and love are should be held to a lower standard.
You have an infinitely
lower standard that, I don't know, a fucking 90-minute comedy should make me so much as smile one time. you know, I feel like that is not
but maybe
too
you're
much
dead
to
inside
ask.
And I enjoyed myself because I'm alive. And I love her.
Maybe that is the difference.
I haven't eaten a Pop-Tart in a million years. Do you guys eat
one
Pop-Tarts?
Love Pop-Tarts. And this movie, unlike Barbie,
maybe that's the problem.
I've always loved Pop-Tarts. S'more Pop-Tarts, so good. I'll try every fucking new Pop-Tart flavor that comes out. You can eat them frozen. You have to freeze a s'more Pop-Tart as they instruct on the box sometimes. So good. And unlike Barbie, which I never, maybe because I never played with Barbies because of gender essentialism, but like I never really felt like that movie was selling me a Barbie doll or like even like that I would imagine taking my daughter to see Barbie when she's old enough to see movies, and that would make her want a Barbie. I don't know, but this movie made me want to go eat some fucking Pop-Tarts, and I went to my Walgreens and
So maybe this is the problem. I could see what's wrong here. I laugh because I have no attachment to Pop-Tarts, and you're too close to the material.
You're right. I was like, how dare they besmirch the good name of Pop-Tarts?
Pop-Tarts deserved a better movie. We've been eating them for ages.
They did deserve a better movie, but I didn't think this was sacrilege in that way. But, like, it's just a very, very unfunny movie. And the upside to it being on Netflix right now is that this doesn't feel like a theoretical conversation. Like, our listeners can go and see that I am not insane. And if they watch it and find anything funny about it, then, you know, the next time
you'll get positive reviews funny, next week,
they can roll with it. But they can go see for themselves. I think that the verdict was rendered swiftly and harshly on this film by the public at large. It's at the top of the Netflix charts by now, but I don't think it's really gonna have much of a legacy.
I don't think we'll be getting Unfrosted to the Scar Giver. You're right.
What about the more R-rated cut?
Yeah, we'll get the R-rated cut. It'll be splooging out Pop-Tart goo more in the uncut.
Yeah, they sploo goop instead of pouring milk in the grave.
Unfrosted. Will you watch it after this debate? I don't know, and I don't care. Have other things to do.
There's so much else on Netflix alone.
I laugh, though.
I don't know if we
trust your taste enough to think that's a reason to watch it.
It's up to you. I will say Jack McBrayer giving real good 30 Rock in this movie.
I mean, we should have mentioned in the segment, like, this is what happens if you take a 30 Rock cutaway joke and expand it into 90 minutes. Like, this is the kind of movie that Jack McBrayer's character would be in, or something that like Alec Baldwin would green light.
It's like that they made Leap Dave Williams as an actual movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Leap Dave Williams.
You could spend your time watching Unfrosted, or you could watch something that is actually good, as I say for my 5 minutes of having watched Unfrosted.
Yeah, you haven't seen it.
There's a show on Hulu called Under the Bridge, which is the kind of thing that I might otherwise instinctively avoid because it is a sort of dark, true story about a terrible thing that happened to a teenage girl in Canada. And I hear you all being like,
is this true crime?
No.
It's not really, it's based on a true crime, but like, I don't know. I'd have to unpack the definition of the term true crime.
Katie, before the segment gets too dark and serious, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Do you ever feel like sometimes you feel like you don't have a problem? Sometimes you feel like your only friend.
There's nobody on this show who feels like they don't have a problem.
Is the city I live in.
They live in Victoria, city Canada, which I had to look up. It's like west of Vancouver. Lonely, it's like on like the tip of like the island, like heading down towards Seattle. He's just going to keep going. So,
and I don't ever want
to. David knows comedy.
You guys stop. I only got five minutes in this little mini segment to tell you to watch this show called Under the Bridge. It's wild that like this show was under the radar, and then like Lily Gladstone damn near wins Best Actress. Then we're like, wait a second, she's got a show on Hulu coming out like in 2 weeks, which is the eternal problem of the peak TV era, which like we're not really in, but we still just have way too many damn shows to watch, especially coming in these last months before Emmy eligibility, which is why I started watching Under the Bridge, because we're in that period where I'm just catching up on stuff. But this one's really pretty good. I've watched 4 episodes of it, I think 5 have aired, so I haven't like seen how the entire thing plays out yet. But you've got Riley Keough, who is playing basically the character of the author of the book that this is based on, which is again a narrative trope that I'm usually like, nah, we don't need like the author in there exploring this story. You just like make the story about itself. But it expands itself really well. It's got Lily Gladstone playing a fictional character who is a cop who is investigating this crime that has happened in 1997. But the real stars of the show, I think, are the teenage girls that it's about. There's one girl who has turned up dead. And then there's a lot of flashbacks going back and forth to seeing her life and her friendship with this group of girls, several of whom live in a group home. And this one actress who I believe is still a high school student in Louisiana, her name is Chloe Guidry. I don't know how you say her name. She has this real like young Michelle Williams look about her. And she's playing the like tough leader of the group who says she wants to like move to New York and meet John Gotti. Like that's literally her. She says it over and over again. And you're like, that has to be based on real life because no one would ever make that up for a teenage girl character. She's like scary and really compelling, as are kind of the other two girls who hang out in her group. And then also Ritika Gupta, who plays Rena Virk, who is not a spoiler alert, the victim of the story. And you get flashbacks to her parents. Her mom is played by Archer Panjabi, who I know people love from The Good Wife, which I didn't watch. But there's just a
Who did love her from The Good Wife?
Juliana Margulies. I'm well aware of that. There's a richness to the story. It like takes its time with all of these people. Like, there's like a little cliffhanger at the end of every episode, so you're kind of watching this like mystery kind of unfold of what happened. But there's just atmosphere and good acting, and Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone are really good together. So I'm really glad that I've watched it, and I get why it might not be something that people run toward, but anyone who has like, you know, a true crime itch, but also maybe wants something that's a little bit deeper and is empathetic and not really going for shock value. And maybe see some of these teenage girls who hopefully are in more stuff, because I think they're all really great. Under the Bridge is airing now. You can catch up before the finale airs on May 29th.
Yeah. First of all, this is true crime, which I'm into. Second of all, I am newly excited to see Riley Keough not as a Sasquatch. This year, so
you did not see Sasquatch Sunset. So
did we talk about that movie?
I don't think we've talked about that. No, maybe we could talk about it in the
that
future.
Movie is sick.
It is an interesting movie. Anyway, Under the Bridge on the Hulu.
On Hulu, worth a shot.
A movie that, I mean, I enjoyed. It sounds like David enjoyed it. Katie, just like thumbs up, thumbs down. Did you have fun with the Fall Guy?
Like trending.
Are movies so back, or are movies just back?
Movies are back if you people go see them, you heathens.
Oh yeah, yeah, no, that's this movie.
So yeah,
no, hang on, we're gonna argue about this. People saw this movie.
But the box office came in a little bit lower than everybody was expecting. I think it's
everyone was seeing Unfrosted. Unfortunately,
yes, that's probably what happened, is everybody was seeing Unfrosted. It did manage to win the weekend, but hasn't crossed the $30 million mark.
This movie opened to marginally less than Blade Runner 2049 did. Like, that's a movie that has like existing IP, Harrison Ford, all that stuff. Like, I think we need to get our expectations in gear. It was not going to open at Guardians of the Galaxy level. No one expected it to, but I don't know. This movie cost maybe more than it should have, but that's not my problem. Well, people went to see it. Made more than Challengers in its opening weekend.
We'll get to talking about the innards of this movie in a second, but you cannot both be defensive over this movie underperformed and didn't do well, and that's not great for movies, and say maybe it cost too much. Like,
I don't know, like whether or not Universal spent too much money on it for, like, you know, if this had been a $60 million movie, then we'd all be like crowing about it. But, like, that's less important to me than just the fact that like a decent amount of people went out to see it. Like, Challengers made $15 million and we were all like, yeah, pretty good. And then this makes double that. And we're like, oh, no, what a disaster. No one cares about movies anymore.
Well, maybe movies should be a middle budget business. Maybe movies should cost less.
I'm fine with that. I just think that being like, oh, the Fall Guy flopped, like, it's a disaster. I just feel like that's not really capturing the whole
thing. The problem is how much Fall Guy cost, not necessarily how much it made. But it, again, it's so frustrating to, you know, be a part of and love an industry. I mean, I guess with the things that come with industry is the fact that, like, people, a medium that I guess is so inextricable from its industry, where everyone feels like how much money a piece of art, ostensibly product, I think in this case is fair to say, made. I wonder what these problems or what this sort of dynamic looks like in, like, the fine arts world. Like, surely there is chatter around how much a piece of art sold for, or, you know, how an artist is doing when their work is know, commissioned for an installation or something like that. But like the fucking peanut gallery judging the sale of everything, I don't know.
Time to rewatch Velvet Buzzsaw.
I mean, for me, the most interesting thing is we don't necessarily know, you know, how this is going to all play out. But it does seem to be sending a message that, like, it's going to be harder to open movies this first week of May, which, you know, was very solidly the, you know, beginning of summer blockbuster week, where you could expect something like this to sort of coast. Because, like, I don't think it's bad. I had a fine time at the movies. People just didn't seem to roll the dice on going to see The Fall Guy for whatever reason. And usually, if you put a Marvel movie on this weekend, even if it's bad, it does pretty well. It performed.
I mean, this is my other takeaway from this is I got out of it and I was like, you know, I would have liked people to see it. I like these stars, but this is not something where I'm going to be like, you people slept on this masterpiece. Like, you don't know what you miss out on. Like, even The Nice Guys, which I was not as big a fan as other people, like, had this, like, drumbeat of support behind it. And I feel like the most people are mustering for The Fall Guys being like, look, we don't get movies like this very often. Like, there's a lot of good stuff in here, which I was more kind of irritated by all the missed opportunities in it than, like, really wanting to be like, no, you gotta go see it. Like, I can't justify that response to this one.
Interesting.
Back up. What is this movie about?
Oh,
this
it's a guy who falls down. Come on.
How do you make a stunt guy... Like, what's the... I haven't read too much about The Fall Guy. I know that it's about stunt people. I know that David Leitch of John Wick, but then he made a bunch of crap like The Hobbs and Shaw, Deadpool 2. He's like...
Mm-hmm. These are your favorite movies.
A guy for hire now.
Bullet Train.
Bullet Train the funniest movie of the 21st century.
Last year, that year's Unfrosted, in my opinion. David Leitch, maybe not the finer of the two filmmakers making the John Wick, but... He's bringing the sensibility of those movies to other types of blockbusters. But what I don't understand, like, what this movie is ultimately about. It sounds like it's more of a rom-com than a stunt, like an action movie. But how where's the drama? Like, why does a stunt guy get into action situation?
So Ryan Gosling plays stuntman Colt Seavers, who injures himself early on in the movie in the middle of a romance with first camera assistant Jody Moreno, played by Emily Blunt. We then jump forward several months. His injury has caused him to slip into a deep depression. He has ghosted poor Emily Blunt, but is called up by a producer they both know, Gail Meyer, who is Hannah Waddingham, is like, hey, Jody's directing her first movie. It's this big, action blockbuster. She really wants you to come and do stunts. We have like an opening on the stunt team. So he arrives.
And challengers for stunts, you know, like injury. You got to coach me.
There's only two people that were sort of romantically interested in here, which is fine because the movie has other things on its mind. Once we get there, he gets there. She doesn't know that he was going to be there. There's sort of like people who ended the relationship poorly. They're going to try to work together to pull off this film. But Gail, the producer, has another ask for Ryan Gosling, which is the film star Aaron Taylor Johnson's Tom Ryder, who Gosling is doubling for, has gone missing. She would like him to go check out his apartment that he's living at while they're filming in Australia to go bring him back to set. And it turns out he is involved in something else that draws Ryan Gosling's cult into, I don't even know if I would call it the underworld, a criminal adjacent situation.
Entirely unclear what situation he has found himself in. To barge in, like, there's a lot of times where this movie does not set up the reality of what it's trying to get you to buy into, either like the depth of a relationship or, you know, you kind of get some momentum and going on a quest and it gets sidetracked. And when you have Hannah Waddingham's producer character being like, yeah, you should go find him because you're a stunt guy and no one will miss you. You're like, it makes no sense for her to put him on this mission. And like, there's wheels within wheels and there's like maybe other reasons for it, but it's still just like, I couldn't buy into why in the world any of this was happening in the first place. And it really put me on a path of kind of questioning the reality of everything that surrounded him since then. Not that it's like a realistic movie, but just the things happen for no reason kind of over and over again to make this plot possible.
Yeah, I didn't see the original series that The Fall Guy was based on, also called
The Fall
Guy.
I don't think it has much to do with this.
Well, it has a lot to do with the post-credit scene where people were like, ah, look at those people. And I'm like, who are those people? And I had to look it up, and it's the stars of the original.
I didn't say for the post-credit
scene. News to me that there's a post-credit scene, but okay.
I mean, the good thing is that one of the things I enjoyed about Fall Guy is it's got a Drew Pearce script who I enjoy all of his work, even if I don't consider all of it to be good. He's one of those writers that I could sort of like picture getting inside of his head, and his decision sort of makes sense to me. And then, you know, Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt are incredibly good at delivering his type of witticisms. But I also agree with Katie that a lot of the time we're just moving on Gosling and Blunt momentum or montage that is cutting in between the charisma these two people have when the plot isn't really motivating us to go that far. But that being said, by the time we got to the end, I was like, you know what? I'm glad I saw this. I'm glad these characters have a resolution to their story. This doesn't feel like an IP to me, so even if it did make, I don't know how much it would have to make to get a greenlit sequel, but that's probably not happening. I'm like perfectly fine as this existing. I guess I was more drawn in by the previews of, can David Leitch extend his sort of action sensibilities into something more rom-com-y? Because he's definitely tried, you know, with like Hobbs and Shaw and Deadpool 2, sort of pushing more into like the action comedy. But like, you know, Atomic Blonde was fun to watch, but that plot's an absolute fucking mess. So just as a fan of the director, I was interested to see if he could push and allow some of the actor's charisma to sort of float his balloons for some scenes. And I think it sort of works like that.
I think the ending is the best part because it puts them kind of in the action together, and it's all based on the movie set, which kind of feels like, even though I think it's a huge misstep that you don't really get what kind of movie they're making or whether or not it's supposed to be bad, which is makes it really hard to invest in like the overall plot where he's trying to save her movie and you're like, is she a moron who thinks this dumb looking sci-fi movie is actually good? But the action all kind of makes sense. But for the rest of it, like, she's doing one thing, he's doing something else totally, and it will like grind the plot to a halt. So they send him, he shows up in Aaron Taylor Johnson's hotel room and you're like, oh, he's going to be investigating something weird. And then she calls him and like, so you're on your track of like, let's figure out where this guy is. And then it has this whole like split screen cute phone call thing where like he's forgotten why he's in this other guy's hotel room where like a bad guy could come get him any minute. And the movie switches gears and then you're supposed to get back into like where the things like that happen all the time where it just can't keep anything on the track that it's supposed to be on, and it feels so frustrating, even though it's it's giving me in those spots. Sorry, you go, David.
It's sloppy as hell. I mean, especially in the second half when the plot really takes over, it really loses steam. But man, that first hour, I was levitating off my seat. I mean, the star power between Gosling and Blunt, the chemistry between them, the confidence of that part of it anyway. And just like how much, and I think for like the first half of the movie, the kookiness, the unreality of it is more of a feature than a bug. I mean, like, it's a classic rom-com. I mean, I think it doesn't ask to be taken any more seriously in terms of its realism than a rom-com would. You know, like, but when all that shtick's happening, he's listening to All Too Well in the car, and you know, she comes, I mean, that's gold.
To be the nitpicker, so like, it's like, okay, he's on a mission, he's gonna go get this car, like something's gonna happen, and then he pauses to listen to All Too Well in the car, and it's like, wait a second, I thought we were doing this one thing. I don't mind doing the All Too Well thing, but it's all that like herky-jerky plotting that kept bugging me. It didn't bug you?
Well, because everything that happens in that first hour is about sort of foregrounding their chemistry. It's all about setting that up, and then nothing else really matters. It's only when the movie says, wait, 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 actually this other stuff matters, and you're like, I promise you it doesn't, that things sort of go off the rails and you start to feel the shoddiness of its construction. You have Stephanie Hsu's character, who you have to imagine had a bigger role in some cut of this movie.
Sure.
And was, no pun intended,
or was it at least around for the first hour, where instead of just popping up like she does here?
Right. Yeah. I mean,
same with Teresa
strong...
Palmer, I would say, who shows up for one, like, I think kind of poorly choreographed fight scene and then is gone.
Mm-hmm. And also that they don't really explain. I mean, she's in the movie within a movie, but
I guess
she's gone as a character. Yeah. And I would have liked to, knowing what the plot ultimately was at the end of the movie, how much did she know about all of that? Uh-huh. It seems like she would know the whole thing. Anyway,
it's weird that she doesn't come back.
Yeah, and I think it hurts that the choreography, I feel like a movie like this, it's going to live and die on its chemistry. But the second thing it's really going to live and die on is the stunts have to be fun. I mean, like, the action has to be a cut above, because that is what this movie is priding itself on. And I think, you know, maybe this is a confirmation bias because I was just generally having so much more fun in the first half of the movie. But it did feel like all of the action was tighter and more exciting in the first hour. And it sort of peaks with the big chase down the main roads, you know, with Stephanie Hsu. And then, like, the second half of the movie where they're plotting these elaborate stunts that are baked into the plot in order to do such and such with the movie. Like, they don't really have that same sort of kinetic thrill.
See, I like the final action sequence the best. So maybe this is just a room for a disagreement here.
I mean, I think the hand-to-hand stuff gets worse, but then the scale that they're at gets higher, so it kind of didn't bother me. Like, the biggest laugh I think I had in the movie is Ryan Gosling's character has a Miami Vice stunt jacket because he used to work on the Miami Vice stunt show, and it turns out, you know, his thing that he used to do is he would, like, jump a boat while tied up and going backwards. And then, like, you know, an hour and 45 minutes into this movie, he's tied up and he jumps into a speedboat and he kind of sighs and turns around. And you're like, fuck yeah, this is working for me.
Yeah, it's like the Challengers thing where you're like, he's going to do the thing, he's going to do the thing, he does the thing.
He does the thing.
Yeah, you're very, there's good payoffs like that throughout the whole thing.
And then I think once Aaron Taylor Johnson shows up, he understands, like, the tone of where he needs to land. I know I didn't see Bullet Train, so maybe he's just redoing his Bullet Train character, but he's able to sort of, like, pull it back to me. But then again, it is probably what you're saying, Katie, which is, like, they do manage to get everybody in the same place, which is the film set for the climax, which ultimately helps just the construction of your movie.
Yeah, yeah, like, Winston Duke is such a great side character, and, like, he has, like, one good fight scene with Gosling earlier, but kind of the rest, he keeps, like, popping in and out when he needs to. And then he gets to be, like, an integral part of that big final action sequence, and it's really satisfying, because, like, most want to see Winston Duke do more stuff.
Yeah, I was watching the Stuntmen React YouTube channel on Corridor Crew, and they had David Leitch on, and he was telling a story of some of the stunts he did for, like, Jean-Claude Van Damme movies. And it turns out one of the stunts in the climax is loosely based on one time he was doing a stunt and wasn't, like, properly rigged and sort of, like, fell from a great height. But his stunt coordinator was able to see that he was going to fall and literally slide a pad underneath him as he was falling.
Mm.
And once I heard that story, I'm like, hey, that happens in The Fall Guy. So, yeah, I think it's just fun. The thing that I'm struggling with right now is I think it should have done slightly better for what this weekend historically does with movies. So maybe a conversation we could have is, are summer movies going to contract? Are we contracting, like, we were kind of hoping back to a middle budget, more middle budget movies instead of a bunch of large.
I mean, it's
just
not the summer. It's another thing. Like, this is not the summer. And May has never been the summer. And all the kids are still in school. All the parents are still at work. Like, it's not the summer. Don't call it the summer.
So we're going to contract.
You know what movies do well? Movies in June and July.
All right.
August is hot. I mean, you know when Beetlejuice 2 is coming out? September.
Like, Avengers Labor Endgame Day. Opened April 30th. Like,
Avengers Endgame is not normal.
I know. It's recognize it is not normal. I don't know. May being the start of summer movie season is perfectly fine with me. But this summer is just going to be, it's going to kind of suck. There's not enough movies. Yeah. There's good movies that are coming, I hope, but, like, there's just not enough of them.
If we're going to have the business conversation, I mean, what Patches is sitting on at the start of the segment is dead on, that, like, you know, we need to, and you're going to see Hollywood do this, push more towards middle budget movies. There is no world in which this movie needs to cost as much as it did. The movie could have been a $60 million movie. It would have been just as good. That may have to change the economics of how some of these movies get made in terms of who's getting paid what. But, you know, it is entirely possible. I think, you know, we need to get back to a world where a movie making $29 million this opening weekend is considered a great success. And that is the only way that this business is going to survive. Or else we're just going to be hand-wringing over things like this until there are no more movie theaters to go watch them. But I think Fall Guy is a lot of fun. It's a movie about, you know, the movies being back. I mean, that's really its theme. It's a love letter to, you know, movie making, one particular facet of movie making. And I think it succeeds on those terms for long enough to be worth it. Would have slayed watching this at like on a hotel TV during a staycation, like some not somewhat better.
See it in theaters. See it in theaters.
No, you should. You absolutely should see it in theaters. I mean, the whole movies are back thing only works if you're seeing it in theaters. But like, the vibe, like I don't know. I like seeing this. I was just sort of in a happy go lucky, happy to be at the movies, happy to see a movie that was happy that I was at the movies to see it.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, totally good vibes.
Yeah, it is good vibes. Like, I got nitpicky in the middle of it and couldn't really pull myself out of it. But, I mean, this movie has a lot of close-ups of both Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling's faces. Like, it knows that, like, that is a special effect of movies, and you don't see a lot of, like, movies on the scale that do that. And I was just very grateful every time that leaned into that. I'm really happy with where Ryan Gosling is landing with his movie star persona. Like, he's bouncing off of Ken in a very satisfying way.
Yeah. I mean, it would be fun if this thing had legs. I mean, I know it's going to get muscled out of premium formats because Kingdom of
the Planet is going to be Elemental, unfortunately.
I mean, but the only thing that's stopping it is if they decide to be cowards and pull it out of theaters, because like Katie was mentioning, we don't have a ton of movies. So
no.
What are you talking about? We have movies that are just like this over and over again. Are you talking... We have the Apes movie. We have Furiosa. This is not an Elemental situation because Elemental can play for kids all summer when nothing is made for kids.
Well, that's why Garfield is
made
on
repeat all summer.
I really wish. I'm sorry. I was just bemoaning this fact this weekend that there was nothing that I could take my son to. There should always be a
Ghibli Fest is playing. There is, thanks to the Studio Ghibli.
That's
commitment
true.
To theatrical.
There's a big
Totoro playing in theaters by me.
There's
this
a
weekend.
Totoro in the AMC lobby that I went to.
There you go.
Yeah, no, but I don't think there's been a major kid release since Kung Fu Panda 4. It's psychotic that they keep doing this. One movie a weekend every weekend, and like when we have a healthy theatrical environment, we've got like a Barbenheimer every weekend, basically. Like, get something for everybody. I mean, I guess they've got the John Krasinski IF opening opposite The Strangers and Back to Black. Like, that's not like they're all different kinds of movies.
If they think I'm bringing any of my children to see the John Krasinski movie IF, they're fucking minds.
You're offending your child's IF. Imaginary friend, it stands for something.
We're going to see if I take Charlie to see the Apes. I'm thinking about it.
You would take your kid to Apes over IF.
I mean, not over IF, probably both. I don't know.
You're turning your back on IF.
I'd be really interested in Charlie's review of Apes, because I think he would be bored by the story and the plot, but he would be so fascinated by just like watching apes be the main characters of a movie
that
it may not matter.
Like the Avatar movies, honestly. Like the Avatar movies, like the plot kind of loses him, but then it just like looks amazing. So do it.
Yeah, I mean, show him an ape and see if he gets into apes. I'm also interested in if he's old enough for Apes, slash, is that just something he's going to find interesting? That sounds interesting to me. Once again, Charlie, so far, the best hope for Fitware Generation 2.
Yeah, we saw Ghostbusters. He liked it. We have not talked about it since.
The rest of you guys are just slow playing the things that you're watching with your kids, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, we're leaning way in.
Fall Guy, in theaters still for a little bit longer.
Go see it.
It's fun. It's fun.
That does it for this week's show. Next week, I'm going to be in Los Angeles and Dave's going to be in Cannes. So Dave and Patches are in charge. We all know what happens when they leave. So everyone keep an eye on them.
Party!
This is the clearest indication we're going to give to that listener that I am not going to be on next week's episode. So please listen with confidence.
It's true. It's the opposite of a content warning. All free and clear. So
and if you're counting, that also means we're pushing our quarter well back until at least the week of the 29th. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that happens. It'll be a good
one. Back to decimals.
Be patient. Back to decimals, back to Dave and Patches. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I am Matt Patches, executive editor of Polygon. I'm on Blue Sky and Letterboxd at Mr. Patches. We have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can prepare for next week's Ape Talk by probably listening to a bunch of ape reviews. I'm sure we talked about all of those other ape movies came out in the span, in the ungodly amount of time we've been podcasting here. So
ungodly.
Go listen to all ape related talk on fightinginthewarroom.com.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the film critic at IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd and my newly locked Instagram account and other places, writing about movies, writing my Apes review should be up. I assume Burger for that is this Thursday, so maybe not up by the time that you read or you listen to this episode if you're listening to it in the day that it drops. Anyway, you can find all of us on the Apple Podcast app. Fighting in the War Room, leave us a review. We'll read it live on the show, even if the gist of your review is fuck David Ehrlich. Totally valid take. One that I have shared, I think, probably more ardently than anyone else over the years. You can also email us if you prefer or not do not have access to the Apple Podcast store. Where can they do that, Dave?
You can email us at fitwr.podcast@gmail.com. I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can follow me at D7E at Twitter and Letterboxd and Blue Sky. I am also on the Trial by Content podcast over on the Ringer Network. This week we are doing best on-screen X-Men. So I have been revisiting all the X films. There are a lot and they're all like 2.5 hours. tune in if you'd like to hear our thoughts on that.
I'm Katie Rich. I am now writing a newsletter at The Ankler. I wrote about Baby Reindeer this week. You've heard me talk about it. I've been writing about HBO. I'm, you know, figuring it out as I go. There will be a podcast eventually, but not quite yet. You can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Katie Rich, KateyRich, on Instagram at Katie Rich Talking. And you can find us all on Twitter and Blue Sky at FITWR, where you can tell us if you think my kid would like to see the Apes movie, or you can answer this week's lightning round question, which was:
in honor of Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes in theaters this weekend, what is cinema's most memorable? Not King Kong, ape, or monkey?
Thanks for listening, and some of us will be back talking to you next week.
Fuck Carolina. Let's go, Rangers!